The Andrea Doria was famous. It was history. Television had made documentaries about the wreck. He asked the clerk if there was still space on the Andrea Doria trip. "The Doria is Mount Everest, buddy," the clerk told him. "It's only for the best. Guys die on the Doria. Start with something smaller." Chatterton signed up for charters to modest inshore wrecks. Each trip fascinated him for the history he envisioned attached to the ship. He returned from these dives so enthusiastic that Kathy found herself signing up for diving lessons. Together they explored dozens of nearby shipwrecks, and Kathy could have been content diving these wrecks. But Chatterton got hungry. He decided to work toward his scuba instructor's certificate, the most sensible way he could think of to prepare to dive the Doria. Late in the summer of 1985, a dive shop owner took stock of Chatterton's passion for shipwreck diving and suggested that he join some of the shop's more experienced divers aboard the Seeker, a charter boat owned and run by Bill Nagel, one of the sport's legends. The owner told him, "Nagel can be an abrasive bastard, but you two seem to share a certain spirit about diving." The Seeker was revelation to Chatterton. Nagel and his customers carried double air tanks, sledgehammers, crowbars, backup lights, and three knives. They studied deck plans and traveled offshore, as far as necessary, to explore the best wrecks. Sometimes they even chased sketchy numbers in hopes of finding a virgin wreck, an impulse that floored Chatterton because it seemed so closely parallel to the spirit of the early American explorers, a group he admired. Nagel hardly grunted toward Chatterton on their first trips together, but Chatterton drank in the captain. Nagel was a pisser. That much was clear before the boat left the dock. But he also seemed consumed with aiming big. Chatterton loitered closer to Nagel, always listening. "What kind of fucking man," Nagel would growl, "says that something's impossible? What kind of man doesn't go look?" Chatterton signed up for every Seeker trip available. On weekends aboard the Seeker in 1986, Chatterton began to notice that the skills he had developed at work seemed to transfer naturally to the business of shipwreck exploration. He found himself willing to swim into crushed and dangerous quarters because he knew he could find his way out. He became calm in low visibility, even as mushrooming silt clouds turned shipwrecks black, because he knew that his body could see. He rolled with the unexpected, and much was unexpected on Seeker trips, because he believed in no matter what. In 1986, when Chatterton volunteered to retrieve the dead diver from the Texas Tower, no other Tower virgin would have considered it. Chatterton went for the guy. Twice. In 1987, Chatterton proposed to Kathy. Since he had bought her a pistol for home protection, Kathy had transformed her affinity for the weapon into a competitive shooting career. She traveled across the country to matches and was on her way to owning several national records. The grind was hard on the couple, reminiscent of the days when Chatterton was at sea fishing for weeks at a time. It made them feel as if they were living separate lives. They missed each other when Kathy was on the road. For his part, Chatterton's intense personal standards of excellence bled into his expectations for others. If a friend or family member or Kathy behaved in a way that Chatterton found wanting, or even believed something that ran counter to his core values, he might go days without speaking to that person. Once, a friend who had promised to help Chatterton rake leaves at 9 a.m. arrived instead at noon. Chatterton walked away from the man, then did not speak to him for a month. "He's not reliable," he told Kathy. "I can't be living like that. Reliability is everything." The couple married on a diving trip to Key West. A few months later, Chatterton earned his scuba instructor's certificate. He now felt ready to challenge the Andrea Doria. Nagel was running a 5-day marathon to the Great Wreck, for which Chatterton signed up and chose a bunk. The trip was historic and produced several museum-quality artifacts. The Doria was now in Chatterton's blood. He began to dream about the wreck. There were places on the Doria that no diver had ever seen, places presumed out of reach. But what did out of reach really mean? In the early months of 1988, Chatterton began training for a return to the Doria, and asking himself why he was so drawn to shipwrecks. As the Doria trip drew closer, he believed he understood. A shipwreck was a vast repository of secrets. Some of these secrets could be uncovered through exploration. They came up in the form of artifacts. Other secrets inside the shipwreck were less tangible. Those were secrets about the diver himself. A shipwreck gave a man limitless opportunity to know himself if only he cared to find out. He could always press further, dig deeper, find places no one had mastered. To Chatterton, there always seemed to be opportunity on a shipwreck, even the simple wrecks, the opportunity to confront the problems really worth solving. And this meant everything to him. This was the act that made his life feel worthwhile. He started to tell colleagues that wreck diving had a lot to do with finding out about yourself. For the next 3 years, Chatterton owned the Doria. He penetrated into third class, second class, the first class galley, all groundbreaking achievements that for years many had thought impossible. In a sport famous for hoarding, he gave away priceless Doria artifacts, asking fellow divers, "How many teacups does one guy need?" He gained a reputation as one of the best shipwreck divers on the East Coast. Some said he might be among the best in the world. One day, Nagel paid him the highest compliment by saying, "When you die, no one will ever find your body." As Nagel spiraled deeper into alcoholism and resentment, Chatterton managed much of his friend's business, so that the seeker could remain viable. He seemed always in good cheer, ready with a dry one-liner and his booming baritone laugh. Yet he was capable of intense reactions when his sense of principle was offended. He could not tolerate the lazy or the immoral in others any more than he could in himself, and pity those offenders who crossed his path. In 1990, he got word of a dive shop owner who had removed a human bone from the wreckage of U-853, a U-boat sunk near Rhode Island. Chatterton phoned him. By now, almost every diver on the East Coast knew Chatterton's name. "I hear you're taking bones off the 853, Chatterton said.
Yeah, I guess word gets around, the man replied.
"You got it up in your house?"
"Yeah, I do."
"What the fuck are you doing?" Chatterton roared. The man chuckled nervously.
"I'm not laughing," Chatterton said.
"Look, man, they were the enemy. Fuck the Germans, we won." Chatterton's voice exploded through the receiver. "I'll tell you what. You're so proud of what you did, I'm going to call the newspapers and have them come over and interview you. Then you can tell them how proud you are to be a grave robber, and everyone in the state will appreciate what a hero you are for stealing bones. Let's make this a big business opportunity for you. I'll call the newspapers right now."
There was silence on the line. "What do you want me to do?" the man finally asked.
"You know what? You fucked up, and you fucked up bad," Chatterton said. "I'm on your ass now, and I'm not going to get off. Those were sailors on that submarine. That's a war grave you robbed. You're going to take that bone back, and you're not going to put it on the outside of the wreck. You're going to put it inside the wreck exactly where you fucking found it. And then you're going to call me back and tell me that you did it. And only then will I be off your ass." A week later, word had it that the bone was back inside the submarine. By 1991, Nagel's drinking had made it impossible for him to dive. Doctors told him his alcoholism would kill him. Still, At night, on the Seeker, while customers slept, Chatterton and Nagel spoke about exploration, about how diving was really about searching, about how beautiful it would be to find something new and important, something no one knew was there. Chapter 5. Crazy Deep. Chatterton stepped inside U-505, the World War II U-boat on display at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry. In every direction, fantastical mechanisms jutted from the walls and ceilings in a forest of technology. Gauges, dials, pipes, conduits, speaker tubes, plumbing, valves, radios, sonar, hatches, switches, levers. Every inch a protest against the idea that men cannot live underwater. The roomiest spots stretched barely 4 feet wide and 6 feet tall. In many places, two children on the museum tour could not stand side by side. To pass into some sections, a crewman would have had to shimmy headfirst through a circular steel door. No one, including the commander, had a bunk that looked long enough to accommodate his body. The audio tour in Chatterton's headphones told about life aboard a U-boat. Crewmen slept in three shifts on the ship's tiny bunks. In the forward torpedo room, the U-boat's largest compartment, perhaps 24 men slept, worked, and ate atop potatoes, canned goods, containers of sausages, and up to 6 live torpedoes. Rough seas often turned U-boats like this one into bathtub toys, tossing crewmen from their bunks and shaking the boat's single cooking pot from the galley's dollhouse-like stove. In icy seas, these overhead pipes dripped with condensation, freezing the necks and scalps of the crewmen. Often the only escape from the chill was in the diesel motor room, where gargantuan twin engines pounded out deafening metal symphonies, creating 100-plus degree temperatures with stifling humidity and causing hearing loss to some of its operators. Wafting carbon monoxide, produced by the engines, chipped away at mental acuity, caused sleep disorders, and became the only recognizable flavor in whatever meal the chef could squeeze out of his postage-stamp-sized galley. Chatterton could see that ventilation was designed for survival, not comfort. U-boats quickly began to stink. Though most U-boats had 2 bathrooms, or heads, one was usually reserved for extra provisions, leaving the other to service as many as 60 men. Flushing was a subtle skill taught in training. If performed improperly, ocean water could backwash into the boat and even sink it. In the war's early days, when U-boats spent much of their time on the surface, garbage was hurled overboard. Late in the war, when commanders kept the boats submerged to avoid detection, crews improvised as the trash began to reek. They stuffed waste into torpedo tubes and pressed fire every few days, a maneuver they dubbed the Müllschuss, or garbage shot. Soon, the stink on the men exceeded the stink of the garbage. The submarine could accommodate almost no personal effects, including wardrobes. Few men owned a change of underwear, opting for whore's undies, a single pair of black shorts that hid the evidence of a month at sea. Chatterton thought, "I cannot believe 60 men lived inside here for months at a time while they terrified the world." Chatterton moved slowly with the audio tour, pressing stop on the player every few seconds to orient himself and make careful mental notes. He studied the composition of shelves, components, gauges, and floors, envisioning each as it might appear covered in sea anemones and rust after 50 years on the Atlantic floor. He craned his neck around machinery and into off-limits areas, looking for anything—a tag, a builder's plaque, a diary, inscribed with the U-boat's number, so that he might search for the same in New Jersey. Everything he did annoyed other visitors. He blocked impassable aisles, backed up into children, wiggled around seniors,
When a tour guide asked him to move along, he exited the U-boat, got back in line, and waited for another turn. The next time, he only pretended to push the buttons on his tape player. In the officers' quarters, he took note of wood cabinets that might survive a half-century underwater and hold important documents. He stopped for a full 5 minutes at the chart table, pretending he could not hear people complaining behind him. The chart table stood beneath shelves of navigational instruments. If he could find those instruments on the wreck, he might have a prime clue in identifying his sub. He got into line yet again. This time his plan was to watch the U-505 sink from underneath him. Inside the boat, he played movies in his mind in which the submarine went down by gunfire, flood, internal explosion, equipment failure. During each movie, he imagined how the rooms in front of him would collapse, how wall-mounted instruments might fall, how floors would accordion, how debris would billow. He imagined where the ship might crack to allow a diver access, and which places he most effectively might swim through. He got into line 6 more times, until he knew these movies like old honeymooners episodes, and the tour guide smirked at Chatterton's pretension to still be using the headphones. At O'Hare, Chatterton bought a yellow legal pad, a pen, and a pink highlighter, and began sketching U-505. He marked in pink the places that might surrender identification tags or other useful artifacts. He made notes like this in the margins. Builder's plaque on periscope, and made of brass. Could be the thing. As he boarded the airplane back to New Jersey, he thought, I accomplished what I came here for. I got a sense, a feeling, an impression of a U-boat. The return trip to the mystery submarine was scheduled for Saturday, September 21st, 1991. The crew and passenger list remained the same, but for one addition and one subtraction. Ron Ostrowski had a family obligation and could not attend. Dan Crowell, a boat captain and longtime Seeker crewman who had missed the first trip because of a business obligation, joined the roster. As the big date neared, the divers could scarcely sit still for their anticipation. Some divers, like Doug Roberts and Kevin Brennan, counted down the days by safety-checking their gear and fine-tuning their setups. Others, like Kip Cochran, Paul Skibinski, and John Yerga, continued to research U-boat construction and lore, hoping for some nugget of insight that might steer them to solving the mystery. Everyone savored the build-up. Wreck divers spent careers dreaming of the chance to write history. These men were 3 days away. Perhaps no one was more excited than 44-year-old Steve Feldman, a top props man at CBS's television studios and the diver who had thanked Chatterton at the end of the Discovery trip. Feldman had taken up scuba 10 years earlier, after a sudden divorce had left him reeling. Feldman had become lonely, obese, and depressed. He chain-smoked parliaments. His friends thought him a kind, unassuming man, and could not stand to watch such a person ache so deeply. They suggested yoga, scuba diving, working out, anything to coax him back into the world. In his thick New York accent, he would only say, "Nah." One day he forced himself to take a scuba lesson. In the water, the world opened up. He devoted every hour of free time to learning the sport. His weight dropped, and his face returned. Handsome Mediterranean features with a thick black mustache and gleaming blue eyes. He quit smoking and joined a gym, all to make himself a better diver. For the next few years, Feldman kept his diving shallow and warm. The sport transformed him. The water was a more basic world to him, a place in which a man could be what he was meant to be. He found a girlfriend. He made himself a regular on Captain Paul Hepler's Wednesday bug runs,
then cooked the lobster he bagged for stagehands and soap opera actors back at the CBS kitchen. He bought a tent so that he could change into his gear on winter beach dives. Soon he was diving shipwrecks. He rarely ventured deeper than 100 feet, and he penetrated wrecks only superficially. But he was hooked on the history that wafted from these ships. He began to sign up for as many wreck dives as he could find. Like many New Yorkers, he owned no car, so he often stood on the street outside his apartment at 97th Street between Central Park West and Columbus, 200 pounds of scuba gear on his back and by his sides, trying to flag down a taxi, most of which would slow down to inspect the Martian-like figure before speeding away. Feldman's friends loved the image, but most of all they loved the delight he took in watching the cab drivers' faces as they passed him by. And they loved that this never upset him, even while he waited in the rain. Feldman arrived at Charter Boats in what became his trademark uniform, wearing a baseball cap with no logo, jeans, and a T-shirt, and carrying a large takeout container of Cantonese noodles with peanut sauce. No matter how high the seas, no matter how brutal the dive, Feldman always ate those noodles, and the empty box in the garbage can became a sure sign on a charter that Feld had been along for the ride. Before long, Feldman had made himself into an instructor. He made deeper wreck dives, to 120 feet, even to 170 feet once, but stayed mostly shallow and warm, allowing the heavy hitters of the sport to tackle the crazy stuff on the eastern seaboard. When Paul Skibinski, a buddy he knew from Hepler's bug runs, invited him along to chase Bill Nagel's numbers, he leaped at the chance. The names Nagel and Chatterton and Seeker were legend in the area. This was his chance to dive with the best. Feldman returned from the Discovery trip transformed. He had splashed shoulder to shoulder with the big shoes. He had touched bottom at 230 feet, far deeper than he had ever dreamed for himself. He was part of a secret group on the lip of history. And he might be the one to identify the wreck. On the Saturday afternoon of the return trip to the submarine, he bought a large box of Cantonese noodles with peanut sauce and lugged his diving gear onto the street. A decade ago he had been lost. Now, as taxi drivers gawked and passed him by, he felt like he was going exactly where he should be going. And this was the thing about diving to Feldman, and it always had been the thing. In the water, self-contained, a man could be what he was meant to be. And when that happened, it was impossible to be lost. The Seeker pushed away from its Brielle dock around 1 a.m. on its journey back to the mystery U-boat. The night was calm and made for sleeping. But everyone stayed awake for this ride. The divers had it figured this way. There were 13 divers on board, each of whom could make 2 dives. That meant 26 dives in which someone had a chance to score a single piece of identification. Today, someone would be the man. Only one man was not giddy. In the wheelhouse, Nagel seemed nervous as he adjusted the Loran units and guided the Seeker out the inlet. "What's wrong, Bill?" Chatterton asked. "I'm nervous that some son of a bitch is going to jump us on the wreck," Nagel said. "Word has leaked out that we're onto something big here."
"Word has leaked out, has it?" Chatterton asked.
"Seems like it, yeah," Nagel said.
"Well, I wonder how that happened."
Chatterton laughed, his booming voice carrying into the salon below.
"If you could have kept your big mouth shut for more than a day, Bill, maybe you'd be relaxed today."
"Ah, shit, I ain't the only one who talked. Look, Bill, no one but us goes 60 miles offshore in late September. Belinda and those guys aren't about doing anything interesting. Even if they've heard that we're doing something great, their laziness would keep them away. They want us to do all the hard work first."
"Yeah, John, you're probably right."
"Oh, wait! Bill, look!"
Chatterton teased. "There's Belinda off to starboard. He's following us."
"Go to hell."
6 hours later, the Seeker reached its destination. The men geared up. Chatterton would splash first and tie in, then go about his dive. While the other divers intended to pick a spot and search for a tag or other piece of identification, Chatterton plans to swim the wreck, orienting himself according to his Chicago memories, looking for nothing but impressions. Only when he understood a wreck did he believe he could formulate a plan to approach it. The strategy made it likely that another diver would beat him to the sub's identity, but Chatterton was willing to take the chance. He staked much of his diving on the principle that preparation came first, so he would not just start digging in hopes that he might get lucky. Chatterton moved down the anchor line. Visibility was decent, about 20 feet. As he neared the bottom, he could see that the grapple had hooked into a metal mass lying beside the submarine in the sand. Its rectangular shape was unmistakable. This mass was the conning tower, the observation post that was supposed to be atop the submarine. He swam forward a few feet. Now he could see the submarine. It lay in the sand, intact, and was shaped, as in the photo books, except for a single striking difference. This submarine had a gaping hole in its side, perhaps 15 feet high and 30 feet across. Chatterton understood metal. This wound could have resulted only from a cataclysmic event. This wound was what had caused the conning tower to fall and collapse in the sand. This submarine had not gone down peacefully. The hole beckoned Chatterton. He could swim inside and search the area for identification before any of the other divers arrived. But that was not according to plan. He swam instead to the top of the wreck and then turned left, studying the boat's topography and making a film strip of mental notes. As he neared the end of the wreck, he came upon the same torpedo loading hatch he had seen on the first trip. That hatch, he remembered, had been on the submarine's bow. Therefore, the hole torn into the boat must be on its port side. A picture of the submarine began coming together in Chatterton's mind. Chatterton reversed course and swam the other way. He nearly reached the stern before his dive timer ordered him back to the anchor line for his ascent. The other divers, the first of whom were now descending, would certainly plunge into the hole and start digging. But Chatterton had gotten what he'd come for. Knowledge. He could save exploration for his second dive. After he studied that picture in his mind and pieced together exactly where he would be going. As Chatterton made his way up the anchor line, the next divers reached the wreck. Skibinski and Feldman got inside the hole near the fallen conning tower and began searching the debris. Skibinski found a foot-long tubular piece of equipment he believed might be inscribed with a serial number. For the next several minutes, both he and Feldman dug in earnest, enthralled by the magnitude of promising debris. But both men had sworn to start up the anchor line after just 14 minutes, no matter how tempting the exploration. Skibinski's watch read 13 minutes. He tapped Feldman on the shoulder and pointed up. Feldman nodded his okay. Skibinski headed for the anchor line and began his ascent. It had taken discipline to leave such a wellspring of artifacts, but the men had stuck to their conservative plan. As Skibinski ascended, he glanced down for Feldman, who appeared to be examining something on the wreck. "He better stop digging and get his ass up here," Skibinski grumbled through his regulator before ascending another few feet. He looked down again, and this time he noticed that there were no bubbles coming from Feldman's regulator. Narcosis started to hum in the background of his mind. "Something's not right," Skibinski told himself. "I gotta go down there and check." He dropped down the anchor line to his friend. Skibinski grabbed Feldman and turned him around. Feldman's regulator fell from his mouth. His eyes were not blinking. Skibinski looked deeper into his friend's mask, But Feldman just kept staring back. He would not blink.
A man had to blink, goddammit. Please blink, Steve.
Nothing.
Skibinski screamed through his regulator. Fuck, 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 fuck!
While the jungle drums of narcosis began their stampede, and he tried to replace the regulator in Feldman's mouth, but that mouth just hung open, which confirmed that Feldman wasn't breathing. And Skibinski screamed,
Oh, fuck! Oh, fuck!
And Feldman only kept staring at him, and Skibinski's head pounded harder, and he breathed harder, which made the needle on his air supply drop. Skibinski wrapped his left arm around Feldman. Questions whizzed through his brain. Should I inflate Feldman's suit with air and shoot him to the surface?
Can't do that. The bends would kill him.
Should I leave Feldman behind and ensure my own safe and controlled decompression?
Can't abandon a friend. Can't abandon a friend. Can't abandon a friend.
Only one option remained. He would carry Feldman with him to the surface. Sometimes unconscious divers snapped out of it with ascent. He had definitely heard about that. Still negatively buoyant, Feldman was led in Skibinski's arm. Skibinski pulled with all he had, gulping air as he one-armed himself and his friend up the anchor line. Feldman arched back in the current, arms dangling at his sides, legs slightly apart, eyes staring straight ahead. With each pull, Skibinski grew wearier and sucked more air. He made it to 170 feet, 165 feet, 160. Then he saw two divers, Brennan and Roberts, above him, coming down. Skibinski released the anchor line to rest for just a moment. Instantly, he and Feldman began to drift away in the current. Skibinski, knowing that he was burning air and could go lost at sea in a matter of seconds, began kicking furiously to regain the anchor line, thrashing against the current until he could no longer maintain a grip on his friend. He let go of Feldman. The limp diver began sinking rapidly, all the while on his back and staring up, his mouth moving open and closed, but no bubbles coming out. Instinctively, Roberts bolted for the body, but Feldman kept sinking. Roberts knew that by leaving the anchor line and chasing this diver, he could go lost himself. But it was a reaction. He could not allow another man to drop into the abyss. At around 200 feet, Roberts thrust out his arm and caught hold of Feldman's harness. But the leaden diver was so heavy that both men continued to plummet toward the sand. Roberts righted himself and began searching desperately for Feldman's buoyancy compensator or dry suit inflation valve. If he could pump air into Feldman's equipment, he might better carry him toward the surface. But Feldman was a morass of equipment, and Roberts could not find any inflation gear under all his stuff. Roberts pumped his own suit full of air, but even that did not arrest the duo's plummet. Both divers hit bottom together. Narcosis began to bang inside Roberts. He looked into Feldman's face. He saw no life. He could not see the wreck. He could not see the anchor line. There was only sand in every direction. We're in the middle of nowhere, he thought. I'm in fucking Never Never Land. I'm lost. As Robert sat on the bottom alongside Feldman, a panicked Skibinski regained the anchor line at about 160 feet. His eyes turned giant, and he rushed toward Brennan, making the slashing across throat motion that indicates a diver is out of air. Brennan had seen the look before. This was panic, the snowball. Skibinski lunged for Brennan's regulator. Brennan backed away. He could not allow Skibinski to kill them both. He reached behind him for his backup regulator and offered it to the thrashing Skibinski. Skibinski took it and started to gulp Brennan's reserve. Brennan began to ascend with Skibinski, stopping with him to do brief decompression stops at 50 feet, 40 feet, all the while thinking, if Doug's still alive, he's got to be lost and freaked out. He's alone down there risking his life to get a guy who's already dead. I have a responsibility to Doug. I gotta go get Doug. At around 30 feet, Brennan passed Skibinski off to another diver and bolted for the bottom to search for Roberts, thereby making himself a prime candidate to go lost.
Sitting in the sand with Feldman at Ocean's Bottom, Roberts checked his gauges. He had burned 60% of his air supply struggling with Feldman. If he stayed much longer, he would incur a decompression obligation beyond his remaining air. Feldman's body lay next to him in the sand, mouth and eyes agape. Roberts's peripheral vision narrowed with his crescendoing narcosis. He could now see only in front of him. He thought, "If I don't get out of here fast, there will be two of us dead on the bottom." The anchor line was nowhere in sight. He would have to swim for the surface, even though that meant that he would likely be blown miles from the seeker by the time he surfaced. He could only pray that someone topside would see him bobbing on the waves before he went lost at sea and drowned. Just before ascending, Roberts began to tie a line to Feldman. That way, if anyone found his body, they could find Feldman, too. He strained to wrap the line around Feldman, but his motor skills were blunted, and he could not make a good knot. He tried again. Finally, he secured the line and began his ascent. Roberts did not know exactly how long he had been on the bottom. He ascended. At 100 feet, the first trickles of light began to spackle the ocean around him, and he saw a miracle. Somehow, in his ascent, he had been blown back into the seeker's anchor line, a huge long shot. He tied the thin nylon rope that led to Feldman to the anchor line, then improvised a decompression stop. Brennan reached him moments later. The two of them made their way to the surface. Brennan climbed aboard the seeker first. Chatterton and Nagel saw him coming up the ladder and figured something was wrong. He had only been in the water a short time. "There's a problem," Brennan said, pulling off his mask. "There's a guy dead on the wreck. I think it's Feldman." Chatterton called to Steve Lombardo, a physician who had yet to splash, and asked him to stand by. Nagel rushed down from the wheelhouse. A few minutes later, Skibinski climbed the ladder. As he reached the top rung, he pulled off his face mask and began sobbing. "He's dead! He's dead!" Then, before anyone could assist him, he pitched forward and fell face first onto the seeker's wooden deck, a 3-foot fall. Chatterton, Nagel, and Lombardo rushed to the mumbling diver, believing he might have broken his neck. They moved Skibinski gingerly, trying to remove his gear. Skibinski could only say, "He's dead. I couldn't breathe. My regulator. He's dead." Chatterton removed the diver's hood. Skibinski was covered in vomit. "Paul, listen to me," Chatterton said. "Did you do your deco?" "I don't know." "You must answer me," Chatterton said. "Did you do your deco?" "Steve's dead," Skibinski cried before vomiting again. "Did you do your deco?" Skibinski managed to nod confirmation that he had decompressed. Roberts surfaced next. "Feldman's down there. You gotta go get him," he yelled. Chatterton did not move. He studied Roberts's face. "Come on, get going," Roberts yelled at Chatterton. "Feldman is down there." Chatterton noticed blood on Roberts's face. His medic instincts took over. "Let me look in your mask," Chatterton ordered. "You might have embolized." Chatterton took the mask. It was full of blood. Roberts coughed up more blood through his mouth and nose. Someone yelled, "Get a chopper!" Chatterton retracted into a new level of calm. He looked deeply into Roberts's mouth and nose. The bleeding had stopped. "I think he busted a blood vessel," Chatterton said. "There's no embolism. Give him oxygen as a precaution. We don't need a chopper." As he breathed oxygen and settled down, Roberts confirmed that Feldman had been without a regulator for close to 30 minutes, that he had tied Feldman to the line from his reel, and that the reel was now tied to the anchor line at about 100 feet. Chatterton gathered Nagel and Danny Crowell. "Before we do anything, we have to get everyone back on the boat and make sure everyone's okay. No injuries, no nervous breakdowns," Chatterton said. "Then we have to go get the body." "Who's going to go?" Nagel asked. "Danny and I will go," Chatterton said. "We're crew. We'll go get him." Crowell nodded.
He and Chatterton figured they would have to wait another 2 hours before they had off-gassed enough nitrogen from their first dives to return safely to the water. Nagel returned to the wheelhouse and locked the door. He had his own decision to make. Coast Guard rules required boat captains to radio immediately whenever a diver went missing. But nothing said that a captain had to drop everything to radio news of a dead diver. Ordinarily, Nagel or any other captain would have called in Feldman's death straight away. It was the decent thing to do, and would expedite the Coast Guard's mandatory investigation. Nagel just stared at his radios. If he called the Coast Guard now, hours before Chatterton and Crowell could even attempt to recover Feldman's body, he would be broadcasting the wreck's location to every boat and seaman in a 30-mile radius, any of whom could use a direction finder to zero in on and steal the wreck site. Worse, he believed that Belinda had moles in the Coast Guard. If he revealed the location, now or ever, it would be just a matter of time before Belinda raided the submarine and stole the Seeker's glory. Nagel made a plan. He would radio the Coast Guard only when the Seeker was ready to pull up anchor and head back to shore. Even then, he would give them just an approximate location of the accident. Why the hell do they need to know exactly where this happened, he reasoned. They aren't coming out here one way or the other for a dead guy. He left the wheelhouse without touching the radios. 2 hours after Skibinski surfaced, Chatterton and Crowell geared up and went to get Feldman. At around 100 feet, they found Roberts's line tied to the anchor line. Feldman should be attached to the line at the bottom of the ocean. Chatterton descended to retrieve the body. He reached the bottom. Connected to the line were Feldman's mask and snorkel, but no body. Chatterton knew what had happened. In the tunnel vision and slowed motor skills of narcosis, Roberts had tied the line to Feldman's head instead of to his harness or tanks. As the current had tumbleweeded Feldman across the sand, the line had slipped over his head, caught on his mask and snorkel, and come free. Feldman was still somewhere on the ocean bottom. Chatterton and Crowell, however, were out of time and could not continue to search for him. They returned to the boat and gathered the other divers. "Listen," Chatterton said, "we gotta go down and try to find this guy. He was negatively buoyant, so we know he's not floating on the surface somewhere. He's in the sand, and he's off the wreck. I don't know that we can find him, but we gotta look." The divers held their breath, hoping Chatterton would not say what he said next. "We gotta do sand sweeps." Wreck diving offers few more dangerous propositions than the sand sweep. The technique is simple enough. A diver ties a line from his penetration reel to the wreck, then backs up in the direction of the current. When he reaches a distance of, say, 20 feet, he walks a 180-degree arc in the sand, searching for scallops or artifacts, or lost divers. If the search is fruitless, the diver lets out more line, backs up farther, and sweeps a bigger arc. The diver's life depends on his line. If he loses the line, if it gets cut on debris or slips from his grip or frays against the wreck, he is gone, a nomad in a featureless landscape without any direction back to the wreck. He then must free ascend, risking a sloppy decompression and the likelihood that he will surface miles from the dive boat and go lost at sea. Chatterton asked for volunteers. It was no small request. The day was getting late, and everyone's nerves were shot, a petri dish for narcosis. And no one could help Feldman anyway. Many divers still had 2 or 3 hours of off-gassing obligation and could not get back into the water before dark. Nagel was in no physical condition to dive. That left just 4 or 5 candidates. Brennan shook his head. "The guy's already dead," he told Chatterton. "I'm not getting bent or going lost to help a dead guy. I already almost drowned from Skibinski panicking, and I cut my deco short. The current is whipping now. There's nothing I can do for the guy. I'm not risking my life.
Chatterton would not risk sending Roberts back into the water. Skibinski was an emotional wreck. John Hildeman and Mark McMahon stepped forward. They would do the sweeps. Hildeman would go first. He was the only diver who had not yet been in the water. If necessary, McMahon would follow. At the bottom, Hildeman attached a strobe to the anchor line. Visibility was perhaps 30 feet. The current blasted past his face. He paid out some line. He walked his arc and scanned the ocean floor. In every direction he was alone. The bloody green of the water grew more eerie with each pass. He found broken pieces of wood, but nothing else. McMahon was next. He tied his penetration line to the top of the wreck, then backed up slowly, allowing 40 feet of line to unspool from his reel, never taking his eyes off the wreck. When the line went taut, he began sweeping, hovering 10 feet above the ocean bottom to broaden his perspective. Nothing. He let out another 25 feet and began drifting backward. The wreck faded into wavy shadow, then disappeared. Now, wherever he looked, McMahon saw only dirty green water, sideways white particulates, and his 1/8-inch white line stretching into the darkness. But no body. The jungle drums beat louder. He let out another 25 feet. A crab popped out of the sand and spoke to him.
"Keep coming, Mark," the crab said. "Keep coming, man."
McMahon was startled. But he was also enchanted. He stopped sweeping and looked closer. More crabs popped out of the sand. They all waved their claws to him. Each of them spoke perfect English.
"Over here, Mark. Over here," they said. "Keep coming."
McMahon wondered if he should follow the crabs out to sea. He took a deep breath. He started talking to himself. "I gotta get out of here," he said. "Crabs are talking to me. When a crab talks, it's time to go home." On board, McMahon told the divers that he too had come up empty. By now, Feldman could have drifted 5 miles from the boat. Dusk was approaching. It was a terrible thing to leave a diver behind, and it would be crushing for his family. But Chatterton and Nagel had reached a limit. "Someone is going to get killed if we keep looking," Chatterton said. He and Nagel agreed to pull up anchor and head back to shore. In the wheelhouse, Nagel radioed the Coast Guard and reported a dead diver. It was 4 p.m., 5 hours since he had first heard that Feldman had died. When the Coast Guard asked why he had not called sooner, Nagel told them he had been busy getting divers out of the water and then organizing the underwater searches. When they asked him for the accident location, he gave them rough coordinates, within a few square miles of the site. That would keep claim jumpers, and especially Belinda, away from what rightfully belonged to the seeker. The Coast Guard ordered Nagel to Manasquan, New Jersey, where it said it would meet the seeker at the pier. The 5-hour ride was melancholy and quiet. Some divers tried to console Skibinski, assuring him that he had done everything possible for his friend. Many speculated as to what had caused the accident, the consensus being that Feldman had succumbed to deep-water blackout, a not uncommon condition of sudden unconsciousness that afflicted divers for reasons science still did not understand. The seeker arrived at the U.S. Coast Guard station in Manasquan Inlet at about 10 p.m. Each man aboard the boat was taken inside and asked to write an account of the incident, then was released. Driving home that night, Skibinski thought back to a conversation he'd had with Feldman over dinner the night before. They had been discussing the trip. Who was going, what they might find, the submarine's identity, and especially how happy they were for the opportunity. Out of nowhere, Feldman had said, "If I ever die, I want to die diving because I love it so much." Now, nearing home, Skibinski reached into his wallet for a phone number. At an Exxon station, he called Feldman's close friend, Buddy, and told him the bad news. Most of the divers called wives and girlfriends from the dock and told them about Feldman. They did so to let the women know they were okay and because they needed someone awake when they got home. Brennan returned after midnight. After his girlfriend went to sleep, he called Richie Kohler. This time he played no Italian accent guessing games with his friend.
"Richie, man, it's Kevin. Something terrible happened."
Brennan's voice sounded so flat, Kohler barely recognized it.
"What time is it, Kevin?"
"You know Feldman?"
"No, who is he?"
"He's dead."
"Who's Feldman?"
"Paul's partner."
"He's fucking dead.
Oh, man, Richie."
"Kevin, what happened?"
"Go slow and tell me what happened."
Brennan could choke out only the most basic details.
"I gotta go, Richie.
I'll call you tomorrow and tell you the whole story."
Kohler hung up the phone. He felt bad for the dead diver. But he had just one thought as he climbed into bed, and that thought hung over him until morning. He had to replace Feldman on the next trip. Brennan called back the next day and told Kohler the whole story. At the end, Kohler spoke frankly. The men were tight and always Brooklyn direct with each other.
"Kevin, you gotta get me on the next trip."
"I know, Richie. I'll talk to Bill today."
Brennan pitched Kohler that afternoon. To Nagel, the idea seemed perfect. Kohler was smart, tough, and relentless, one of the best wreck divers on the eastern seaboard. He had steeped himself in World War II history and knew German lore and artifacts. He was at home in crazy deep water, and he would not go and get himself killed, the last thing Nagel needed after the Feldman accident. Ordinarily, Kohler would have been included from the start of the expedition. But there were issues. First, Chatterton disliked Kohler, not just personally, but for what he represented. Kohler was a member of the infamous Atlantic Wreck Divers, a hardcore and exclusionary dive gang that wore matching skull and crossbones patches sewn under their denim jackets and raised hell on the boats they chartered. They were fearless and first-rate wreck divers. Chatterton would give them that. But he despised their overriding lust for tonnage, a collective instinct to take every last piece of crap from a wreck until their goodie bags bloated with artifacts and their supposed manhood. None of them seemed to Chatterton to love diving for knowledge or exploration, or for what the sport might reveal to a man about himself. They wanted shit and lots of it, period. If Kohler's membership in Atlantic Wreck Divers was his only failing, Chatterton could have forgiven that. He dove often with a few of the gang's members and liked those men personally. But Kohler had committed a far graver sin, maybe the worst sin, and it was this black mark that lingered with Chatterton. 2 years earlier, Kohler and others had set out on a mission that would fuck the Seeker. Late in 1989, Chatterton had squeezed through a tiny opening that led to the third-class dining room on the Andrea Doria. Many divers had spent years trying to access third class, but none had succeeded. Inside, Chatterton saw mountains of glistening white china, more than Seeker divers could haul out in years. Chatterton considered it a big opportunity for Nagel. Divers would kill for a place on Seeker charters for access to these artifacts. The problem was that few besides Chatterton had the skill to shimmy through such a tight opening. He proposed a wild solution. He could use a Broco underwater torch on the next trip and burn away one of the steel bars blocking the opening. After that, anyone could swim in. Nagel told him,
"You are one amazing son of a bitch."
On a special Seeker run to the Doria, Chatterton assembled the torch and rigged its onboard oxygen cylinder and the hoses that delivered its fuel. Underwater, he changed into a diving mask, to which he had taped a welding shield, and fired up the Broko. The torch spit blinding red and white sparks as its 10,000-degree Fahrenheit rod boiled the ocean around it. That day, Seeker divers hauled perhaps 100 bowls and dishes from the Doria, the first artifacts ever to come out of third class. One of the divers took video to commemorate the historic occasion. At the trip's end, Nagel gathered the divers. "It's too late in the season to come back," he said, "but first thing next year we come back and kick ass in third class." A short time later, someone from the Seeker turned traitor. A copy of the videotape was leaked. Kohler and some other members of the Atlantic Wreck Divers watched the tape, astounded as Chatterton used the Broko to burn his way in. Impossible! As the bar fell away and the hole opened up, the video showed a white mountain of dishes inside that looked piled by Walt Disney himself. More than one man muttered, "Holy shit!" The video lasted just a few minutes. Kohler had never seen a bounty like this. Every cell in his body lusted for the easy ransom glistening in the room that Chatterton had opened. But there was bad news. Word had it that Chatterton and Nagel were planning to go back to the Doria early the next season, long before most boats would even consider tackling that wreck. Their mission? To haul every last artifact from the area and leave nothing for Belinda or the Wahoo. Often a ribbon of salvation runs through the lives of deep shipwreck divers. This time that ribbon weighed 215 pounds. Belinda had planned his own trip to the Doria, a charter scheduled just 2 days before the Seeker's. Kohler and the others could be there just in time to waltz into Chatterton's area and take away as much as they could carry, leaving the site damn near empty by the time the Seeker got there. Knowing the bad blood between Belinda and Nagel, Kohler believed this to be a heaven-sent opportunity for Belinda. But the idea of beating Nagel to the Doria grinded against Kohler's ethic. You don't jump another guy's claim. Still, the video was irresistible, the china so magnificent and endless. Kohler had met Chatterton just once, briefly, so he was not concerned about the skinny guy with the blowtorch. He liked and respected Nagel, and had had only positive experiences aboard the Seeker. He also believed Belinda a blowhard and a follower, not a doer. He snickered at the name King of the Deep. But the china was so beautiful and stacked like snowy mountains, and his fellow AWD guys were going and... "Sign me up," he told Belinda. Kohler could not remember ever seeing Belinda so ravenous to lead a charter. Belinda's trip was scheduled for June 23rd, just days before the Seeker's. Kohler kept his mouth shut about the charter. But someone's conscience had kicked in. The plan was leaked to Nagel, including the date of the Wahoo trip. Nagel called Chatterton, drunk and furious. "Those motherfuckers!" he screamed into the telephone. "We gotta do something." Chatterton devised his own plan. He and Glenn Placoy, an engineer and frequent Seeker diver, would build a metal grate to block the opening Chatterton had burned into third class. The Seeker would go to the Doria 2 days before Belinda's trip. They would fill their bags with china. Then Chatterton and Placoy would install the grate. When the Wahoo divers arrived, they would find the hole closed. The plan sounded perfect to Nagel. But Chatterton never stopped at phase one of any plan. He formulated additional criteria. He and Placoy would design a grate that they could open and close. Simply welding a grate in place would lock out everyone, including Seeker divers. The grate must appear to the Wahoo divers to be loose and easily removable, so that they would waste time and look foolish struggling with it. The grate must still allow a diver to pass through the tiny opening Chatterton had originally wiggled into, so that anyone wanting to work to get in, as Chatterton had, retained that opportunity. Chatterton and Plekoy went to work on the design in a local dive shop's classroom. They studied the videotape and took reference measurements, then sketched plans for a 5-by-6-foot, 300-pound iron